Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Here's some irony. As unpopular as the United States Congress is, it takes a senator to make the point.
I love working for the people of Indiana. I love helping our citizens make the most of their lives. But I do not love Congress.
Senator Evan Bayh, a Democrat, calls it quits, saying Congress is too partisan, too ugly, even for a two-term senator, even for a son of a senator, to go on.
There is much too much partisanship and not enough progress.
Does quitting in protest shake Congress awake, or just let it wave by to another bipartisan pest, Evan Bayh the enforcer or Evan Bayh the enabler? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 16th. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this week. Of course, I'm here with Celeste Headlee. And Celeste, my takeaway is, we have to take Evan Bayh at his word that Congress is just too partisan for him to enjoy it. But it's not like he was elected yesterday. He's been in Congress for 12 years, and his father was a senator, and this is not the first time it was partisan.
It's not. But, even I, who've been covering politics for many, many years, kind of feel like right now it's pretty bad. So I kind of empathize with Bayh. This is the only time you're going to hear me say that about a senator. Let's get right to the top stories this morning. U.S. officials say they've captured the Taliban's top military commander. Mullah Abdul Baradar was detained over a week ago in Pakistan during a joint Pakistani and American raid. He's said to be the second in command behind the group's spiritual leader, Mullah Omar, and one of the Taliban's four founders. Earlier, we spoke to Christine Fair, a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She said she was surprised that Pakistan had helped the CIA track down Mullah Baradar, because traditionally, Pakistan has seen the Taliban as an ally.
Pakistan has really come under a lot of pressure from the United States because of its reluctance and even refusal to take action against the leadership of the Afghan Taliban that remain in Pakistan.
Baradar is being held in Pakistan, where officials hope he'll provide the whereabouts of Mullah Omar, the Taliban's founder and spiritual leader. Meanwhile, across the border in Afghanistan, the battle continues for the city of Marja. U.S. officials say half the town's Taliban have either fled or been killed, but those left behind have been stepping up their counterattacks and slowing down the NATO advance.
Here at home, you heard us talking about it just a few minutes ago. Senator Evan Bayh, a leading moderate Democrat from Indiana, says he will not run for re-election this year. He cited the toxic atmosphere in Congress as his main reason. We're joined now by Adam Nagorny, chief political correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Adam, good morning.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Fine, thanks. How much of a surprise, really? I mean, I was in the Senate a week ago. Evan Bayh was introducing major legislation on debt reduction. He's been raising money like crazy. Was this really a big surprise?
Yeah, people around him had a sense that he was uncomfortable with the job and had been thinking about leaving. But the timing of it caught a lot of people by surprise. As you said, he's raised a lot of money. He had petitions ready to go. Tuesday's the deadline for filing, so I think you could say people were really kind of shocked by this.
He was showing a lot of frustration, but didn't really show any signs of wanting to bow out. I mean, people were talking about a race between him and Republican Dan Coats.
Yeah, no, I know. In fact, one of the things that was interesting that was going on, Dan Coats has emerged as one of the leading Republican contenders, and there's been a real considered effort by Democrats, including Evan Bayh's operation, to sort of raise questions about Coats' candidacy, which is a classic sign of a guy clearing the field to get himself ready to run. So it really, really caught a lot of people by surprise.
All right, Adam Nagorny, stay with us because we're going to talk about it more with you in just a moment. Going to the markets now, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up, too. The Dow gets underway at 10,099. The S&P opens at 1,075, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,183. Coming up, we'll take a look at Mardi Gras music. We're also looking this morning at turning what you love into a paying gig. Do you have a hobby that you'd like to turn into a career? Tell us about it, 877-78-MY-TAKE. Post to our website at thetakeaway.org and learn more about it on our site, too.
Coming up, more on why Senator Evan Bayh is not running for re-election and what this could mean for other incumbents going into the 2010 elections.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here, filling in for John this week. We start out the hour with some more bad news for congressional Democrats.
I love working for the people of Indiana. I love helping our citizens make the most of their lives. But I do not love Congress.
There's a statement that's calibrated to hit on the sentiments of the public. Not many people love the Congress these days. That was Indiana's Democratic Senator Evan Bayh saying he's done with the Senate and will not seek re-election in 2010. That unexpected announcement comes at a time when both Democratic and Republican incumbents prepare for a shakeup in the 2010 midterm elections. Many incumbents are finding themselves in tighter races than expected, especially on the Democratic side, probably because right now Americans are a lot like Evan Bayh, and they're not feeling much love at all for the United States Congress. Back with us is Adam Nagorny, chief political correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, and also Lisa Mascaro, Washington correspondent for the Las Vegas Sun, who covers Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, who's in a tough race of his own back in Nevada, a Democrat fighting for his seat. Adam, back to you just to start. You have a piece in the Times this morning. You say that Bayh's announcement increases the chances of a Republican takeover of his seat and gets the Republicans closer to really knocking down that Democratic majority in the Senate. Why does Indiana carry so much weight as a bellwether here?
Well, two things. I wouldn't look at it so much as a bellwether, but it's a state where Democrats controlled by seat, and it's still a Republican-leaning state, notwithstanding the fact that President Obama won there last time. I remember that was the first time a Democratic president had won there since, I think, Johnson in 64, off the top of my head. So it's not an easy state for Democrats. You know, Evan Bayh is one person that Democrats thought could, you know, win that seat again, and as it was, Republicans were going to make an effort against him. I think he was going to win. So that's why it's bad news for Democrats. I still think that the Republicans have a long way to go to take control back of the Senate. I mean, the Democrats now have a 59-41 advantage there, and 9 seats are a lot of seats. Now, there are a lot of Democratic seats in play, including Harry Reid's, as you just said, but the Republicans also have to hold on to a bunch of seats as well, including, you know, where they could have problems, open seats, Kentucky, Missouri, Ohio, New Hampshire. So I think clearly the Democrats are going to suffer some losses and probably significant ones. I'm not quite sure they're going to lose control. But
right. A lot of retirements on both sides.
Yes, sir.
You know, Bayh's reasons for leaving were different than somebody like Senator Chris Dodd, who's also decided not to run for re-election. Dodd basically said, I've seen my numbers. They are bad. I can't win. I'd rather leave than risk losing. Evan Bayh said nothing of the sort. He just said, I can't stand the atmosphere anymore. Do we take him at his word, or does Evan Bayh know something about his prospects that we don't, and he's putting sort of the best face on it here?
Yeah, this is a question that we were wrestling with yesterday as we were reporting and writing the story.
Right.
I think the bottom line is that we do take him at his word for two reasons. One is, you know, everything we've heard is that while he might have had a difficult race, he's going to win. I mean, he was in pretty good shape. He had a lot of money. He's popular there. He's won his last two Senate races.
His last name is Bayh.
That's no small thing. He's a member of the big of a political dynasty there, which goes to the other thing. What makes his sort of announcement so remarkable and so, I think, credible, you know, I talked to him yesterday, and he's talking about when he used to go to the Senate with his father, Birch Bayh, like, you know, I think he was senator from, like, 69 to 83 or something like that, a long time ago, and how different he said it was then. He said senators were friends. You know, they socialized at night, and he said they really did, when push comes to shove, put aside politics, you know, when it came to dealing with a crisis. Now, there could be some kind of idealized memory there, but I think it is really true, and he's a testimony to it, to how much things have changed for the worse there. And, you know, I think the takeaway of Dodd was very much Democrats are in trouble and Dodd is in trouble. I mean, that was very clear,
right?
You know, and he was very candid about it. I think the takeaway here is that something is really wrong here when a lot of a qualified person like Bayh, whatever you think of him politically, doesn't want to be in what you would think would be one of the most prestigious jobs in the world. Right?
And already the buzz around him, Adam Nagorny, is that he may be positioning for a presidential run. We'll have to see. Republicans licking their chops about their prospects in Indiana and also licking their chops in Nevada. Lisa Mascaro, you cover the majority leader, Harry Reid, who's in a tough race. Majority leaders don't usually lose their races at home, but it can happen. How is Harry Reid polling right now?
Hi, Todd. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure.
You know, Reid's polling in Nevada, the outside polling that we've seen shows him just really facing an uphill battle. He's, you know, down in the almost George W. Bush territory, you know, in the 30s. Reid's own internal polling, which his campaign has not released, shows him faring better The polling that's out there also shows Reid at this point, frankly, losing to the potential Republican matchups in this state. Again, Reid's own internal polling, says he's doing better than that. So Senator Reid faces a really uphill battle. Back home, it's an interesting situation. He's been in office. This will be his fifth term he's seeking as a senator, and often in a small state like this, where someone has achieved so much power and clout and is able to sort of do so much for his state, that engenders them to their folks back home. And in Nevada, you kind of have the opposite effect, where there's a little bit of what people call Reid fatigue, where they kind of want to know, what have you done for me lately? And, with the economy so bad in Nevada, with the foreclosure crisis and the lack of tourism really hurting the gaming industry, folks are really looking to Reid as what is your powerful position done for us?
So it's a skittish year for all incumbents. But I want to ask you about Reid's position in particular. With Congress being as unpopular as it is, I'm going to be charitable and say their approval rating is 16% at the top end.
Maybe
yeah. Celeste, you've been quoting numbers like 13, yeah. Abysmal. Somebody who's a majority leader is inextricably tied to that, right? He cannot separate himself from the poor approval ratings of the Congress.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you've seen Republicans early on go after Reid as the majority leader from the time, even when he was the minority leader before Democrats had control of Congress in 07. Republicans really sort of putting that target on his back, hoping to do to him what they did to Senator Tom Daschle in South Dakota back in 04, really tying him to that. And I think you really see it on health care, too, where, the big health care debate, that was Reid's bill. Reid eventually crafted that bill, merging those bills together. So he really has ownership of that. Some people think in an odd way that could help him in the end. But I think conventional wisdom mm-hmm. says that, these things that people don't like coming from Washington, have Reid's name all over it.
And Harry Reid has turned the agenda now to jobs, 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 as he says it, not just a jobs bill, but a jobs agenda, trying to save the Democrats as well as himself. Lisa Mascaro, Washington correspondent for the Las Vegas Sun, and of course Adam Nagorny, chief political correspondent for the New York Times. Those are Democrats in the Senate and a skittish 2010 election. Thank you. Now let's check in on some stories we're following at 15 minutes past the hour.
Officials say a joint CIA-Pakistani operation is responsible for the arrest of a top Afghan Taliban leader. Mullah Abdul Baradar was arrested in the Pakistani city of Karachi over a week ago. He oversaw the group's military operations, finances, and leadership council. This morning, Senator John Kerry told CBS the operation represents significant progress in U.S.-Pakistani relations. Later this hour, we'll find out why we're only learning about the capture more than a week later with New York Times executive editor Bill Keller. In Afghanistan, U.S. Marines are pushing further into the Taliban stronghold of Marja. It's the fourth day of the offensive, and militants have reportedly stepped up their counterattack. And in Haiti now, the Canadian government says it'll spend $12 million to build the Haitian government a temporary base. The new base will accommodate key ministries for up to a year.
In Pennsylvania, the funeral is today for late Democratic Congressman John Murtha. More than 30 members of Congress are expected to attend. Murtha was 77 and died after complications from gallbladder surgery. At the Olympics, men's snowboard cross gold medalist Seth Westcott says he's excited to have won the only two gold medals ever awarded in the event.
Yes. Amazing to be able to do that as part of the history of snowboarding.
Also at the game, skier Bodie Miller won bronze in the men's alpine downhill. The U.S. leads the medal count with 8. And finally, it's Fat Tuesday, and despite cold temperatures in New Orleans, the festivities at Mardi Gras continue today with a variety of marching clubs. Last night, people partied on Bourbon Street in the French Quarter until the wee hours. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we talk about the Winter Olympics and the start of men's hockey. That's coming up in just a few moments.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some takeouts on the news stories that we're following this week. We want you to stay on top of. President Obama is facing new opposition to his plan for limiting the size of banks. The opposition is coming from the European Union. Finance ministers in the EU have united against the so-called Volcker rule, which would prevent commercial banks from owning hedge funds and taking excessive risk. The shorthand for this is kind of too big to fail, or letting the banks get entangled in too many financial instruments that got them in trouble in the first place. New York Times finance reporter and contributor to The Takeaway, Louise Story, is here with us in studio. Morning, Louise.
Morning.
Louise, what is President Obama trying to do, and frankly, why would Europe have a problem with it?
So this is known as the Volcker Rule.
The Volcker Rule.
Yes, because, you know, the former head of the Federal Reserve has proposed it, Paul Volcker. But what it says is that banks that take deposits and make loans, those very activities that we want to preserve, those are the activities that called for us to rescue banks. Banks that do those activities should not also do risky trading and own hedge funds or private equity firms. So it's calling for a separation of banking, deposit-taking, lending from risky trading.
Keeping banks a little bit in the safety zone, in other words, to do what they were meant to do.
That's what it's supposed to do. Now,
the EU has a problem with this, apparently.
Right. So Bloomberg News uncovered this memo that shows that the EU is going to be coming out, the finance minister saying that they think that this is not a good idea. And in particular, the finance ministers over in Europe are concerned that this would push risk out of the financial system. And this opens a fundamental debate. So in the U.S., the Obama proposal talks about it being good to push the risk away from these big banks, okay? Because then we won't bail out banks in the future that do these trading activities. But then in Europe, they're saying, well, we need to keep the risk in the system because that's what we monitor. That's what we can control. Mm-hmm. That's what we can handle. And the fear is that if you push things out of the system, they're in the shadows. You don't really know what's going on, and they may cause even greater risk. So it's a fundamental debate over this.
I can envision analysts down on Wall Street at the firms that you cover sort of secretly saying, yes, go EU, standing up for them at a time when maybe they can't because they're not popular enough to stand up against the Volcker Rule.
They may be rooting for that. You know, also today, Henry Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, has an opinion piece in The Times where he talks about how important it is that we pass financial reform. And, you know, Paulson's the former CEO of Goldman, so he has both the government perspective and the banking perspective. But he said, we've got to pass the financial reform. And in particular, he says, it's very important to have a systemic risk regulator, someone who's watching all the risk. That's a proposal that's sort of fallen off the table.
Okay, but in the world, but quickly, though, if Obama succeeds here in the United States with Paulson's backing for major financial reform and Europe doesn't come along in the world of interconnected banking, what does that really mean?
Well, the EU will do their own version, of course. The fear is if one country has much harsher rules, will banks move more of their activities to other countries?
Just fly to where you can make more money because you can take more risk. All right, Louise Story, finance reporter for The New York Times and contributor here at The Takeaway. Thanks for joining us.
For our next takeout, let's go to Vancouver for the Olympics. And we're joined by Dan Friedel. He's covering the Winter Games, and he's specifically got his eye on hockey, which makes you one of about a million or so in Canada, right? I mean, if you're talking about hockey, Canadians are hockey fanatics. That must add an extra bit of excitement to the beginning of the men's hockey.
Yeah, you'd have to say there are about 30 million hockey fans here, Celeste, and they're all raring to go. You know, you just look around on the streets of Vancouver as the games have gotten started, and there are tons of Canada hockey jerseys out there, even though, as you know, the Canadian Olympic hockey players didn't even march in the opening ceremony.
Well, you know, a lot of people in the United States, of course, are looking to the U.S. team, but they struggled to get a seventh-place finish in Torino. Can we expect the U.S. team to make a good showing in the Olympics?
Well, Brian Burke, who is the kind of bombastic figurehead of a general manager for the USA team, has made it clear that he looked for a team this year that I wouldn't say was bereft of all-stars, but was kind of filled with a new breed of player. And the idea is that he wanted to have guys who didn't mind being the brick and mortar so that the team might be a little bit tougher and grittier and wasn't looking just for all the glory, that they were willing to do the hard work. And, you know, the team is clearly not a favorite because you've got such a star-studded group of teams from countries like Canada and Russia and Sweden. But, you know, they'll probably have a shot to make it into the bronze medal game.
Well, they're facing off against the Swiss today, and that's going to be a tough fight against the Swiss. They've got a great hockey team out there. You know, you talk about all-star hockey players and bright stars in the sport, but we're not talking about pampered athletes here.
Well, just hours ago, when I was coming back from a hard day of work yesterday, I was on the SkyTrain, which is what they call the metro or subway here in Vancouver, with three of the players from the Slovakian hockey team. I mean, this is like Brooklyn Dodgers in the 20s and 30s, where you're riding the streetcar with the guys who you're about to go see in, you know, 30,000, 40,000 seat stadium.
Pro athletes on public transportation.
Yeah, and it was the same thing when I arrived on Sunday at the airport, where the biggest star of them all, Alex Ovechkin from the Russian team and the Washington Capitals, was up on the conveyor belt at the Vancouver International Airport, grabbing these giant hockey bags for his Russian and Washington Capitals teammates. They had all just arrived from their road trip, the last road trip before the NHL went on its break, and he was, you know, smiling like a kid on Christmas morning, you know, with all these bags to grab off of the conveyor. And I went up to him and I said, you know, don't you have an assistant who's going to do that for you? And he kind of smiled and said, I don't need an assistant for this. You know, he clearly is just happy to be there.
Yeah, I can get it myself. Don't worry about it. Thanks, Dan Friedel is a freelance sports reporter up in Vancouver. He's covering the Olympics there. The U.S. team is facing the Swiss team today. We're going to have more coverage on the Olympics all week long. You can check out our coverage on our site, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, more details about the capture of the Taliban's top military chief and why we're only learning about it now. Good morning. John Hockenberry is away all week, and Todd Zwillick is here with me, filling in for John. Here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. U.S. officials say they've captured the Taliban's second-in-command. Mullah Abdul Baradar, the group's top military commander, was captured more than a week ago in Pakistan during a joint Pakistani and American raid. Baradar is being interrogated in Pakistan, where officials hope he'll provide the whereabouts of Mullah Omar, the Taliban's founder and spiritual leader. Why are we only finding out about this now, more than a week after his capture? We're going to find out from the New York Times executive editor, Bill Culler, in just a few moments. Meanwhile, explosions are ringing out in the Afghan town of Marja. It's day four of the offensive to drive insurgents out of that city. But Taliban fighters are stepping up their counterattacks. They're slipping behind U.S. lines and opening fire. Afghan Interior Minister Hanif Atmar says a group of tribal leaders are now helping NATO troops by pointing out enemy locations.
The operation has full support from our people, especially the special council that has been established from the true representatives of Marja.
So far, NATO says at least 15 civilians have died in the fighting.
Here at home, Senator Evan Bayh, who's decided not to run for re-election this year, tells CBS News he's not leaving his party in a lurch.
I'm not angry at my party. I wish Washington would work better. And I had discussed with Senator Reid as long as a year ago my growing feeling that Congress was just not working as well as it should.
Bayh denies he's got his sights set on a presidential run in 2012. A new federal audit shows the Census Bureau wasted millions in preparation for this year's population count. That includes thousands of temporary employees who picked up $300 checks without doing any work. More than 30 members of Congress are expected to attend the funeral of late Congressman John Murtha this morning. The Western Pennsylvania Democrat died last week at the age of 77 after complications from gallbladder surgery. The markets are now open. The Dow is up about 67 points at 10,166. The S&P is up about 8 at 1,083. And the NASDAQ is up about 14 points at 2,197. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
We've been reporting all this morning about the story that our partner, The New York Times, broke last night. It's about the capture of the military leader of the Taliban, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar. The story hit The New York Times website last night, but The Times actually first learned about the arrest last Thursday. The paper held the story at the request of White House officials. And Bill Keller, the executive editor of The New York Times, joins us now. Good morning, Bill.
Morning, Celeste.
So explain the delay. The White House called you and asked you not to print the story?
Well, actually, we called them. Mark Mazzetti and Dexter Filkins had the story pretty well nailed down, as you said, last Thursday, and they took it to the White House for comment, of course, as we routinely do. And the folks at the White House said, "Well, hold on for a second. We need to talk to you about this." Several of the people from our Washington Bureau went over to the White House and sat down with people from the National Security Council and the press office, and they said that they were pretty sure that Mullah Baradar's colleagues in the Taliban were not yet aware that he was in custody. It had been I don't know the details of it, but they thought it had been a clean snatch. And they were afraid that once the word got out, other Taliban officials would go deeper underground or start taking measures to cover their tracks. So they asked us to hold off for a while.
Well, I'm going to ask you in a moment what went into your decision to do it as they asked. But first, let me try and get the timeline of events down clearly. Your reporters from independent sources learned about this out of Pakistan.
Yes, Pakistan and Afghanistan.
And then you went to the White House to get comment on it, and that's when they told you, we want you to hold the story.
That's correct.
Until today, or until last night.
Until last night, right.
So why did you decide to do this? You don't always acquiesce to these kind of requests.
No, we get asked to withhold information, not often, but from time to time. Sometimes it's, you know, just it's a no-brainer. You know, we have reporters embedded in military operations. Obviously, they don't file information that would put troops at risk. We've had other stories that were much more controversial where we decided that we would publish. This one was not, honestly, a very hard call. Obviously, we were eager to break the story. It represented a lot of resourceful reporting by Mark and Dexter. But there was no obvious public interest reason to rush the story into print, and you know, we are responsible people. We didn't want to compromise what sounded like a potential intelligence coup.
And certainly the story retains just as much power more than a week later as it would have had you broken it right at the time. Is that kind of your thought process?
Yeah, I think that's the thought process. And, you know, what actually happened was yesterday our stringers in Pakistan and Afghanistan started calling our bureaus there and saying, you know, we're hearing reports that Mullah Baradar is in Pakistani custody. And we took that to the White House and they said, yeah, we understand. Okay, it's not holdable anymore.
Right, so you published it. Now, you visited the White House in 2006 while President Bush was in office, and you were getting ready to publish a story about domestic wiretapping. And very famously, you were told that if you published that story, you'd have blood on your hands. Was that the kind of dire warning you got from the Obama White House?
Oh, no. This didn't even get to my level. I mean, they dealt with Dean Baquet, the Washington bureau chief. I mean, obviously, if they had felt they needed to call me, I'm always willing to take a call. But it didn't even rise to that level. It was, back in 2006, the conversations were professional and civil. But in the end, when we didn't agree to hold the story as they wanted us to, it was a kind of firestorm of criticism from the White House aimed at the Times. So far anyway, we haven't had that kind of acrimony with this administration, nor as far as I know have other news organizations.
What's the kind of bar that you have to come up to in order to decide that a story is worth holding at someone else's request? I mean, do you have to check in to make sure that the White House isn't making that request for their own unspoken selfish reasons?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, you don't want to, on the one hand, I don't have subpoena power. I don't have, spies in the National Security Agency. So knowing, whether publishing a story would actually put national security at risk is a harder thing for me to figure out than it would be for somebody who's actually in the government. But we do our best job of doing that, and we take these requests quite seriously. I mean, I think the first one that I ever dealt with was when I was foreign editor in the Clinton administration, and we learned that there was a large unsecured stash of highly enriched uranium in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. We held that story until the material was secured. Was not that hard a call. There are others where, to this day, we can't talk about things that we've held out because they would, endanger agents who are working on in foreign countries.
Bill Keller, Todd Zwillicker, I want to ask you quickly just the timeline between having the story nailed down in Pakistan and revealing it. You said your stringer started to hear reports in public there that Baradar was detained. Was the Times chomping at the bit to release the story? At what point would you have released it had you not heard those reports in public? Were you waiting from go-ahead from the White House?
Well, we were a little chomping at the bit, yes. But we checked in with the White House every day, and we also checked in with our people on the ground. And when it became clear that it was leaking out, the rest of it was resolved pretty amicably.
Bill Keller is the executive editor of the New York Times. The New York Times got reports about the operation that in which Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar was captured. They got those reports last Thursday. They delayed reporting it at the request of White House officials. Thanks so much, Bill Keller. Coming up, we're going to take a look at Mardi Gras music, all the way from classics back in the 1930s and 40s to the newest incarnations of Fat Tuesday soundtrack music. Remixing Fat Tuesday, coming up later this hour with Grammy Award-winning artist Terrence Blanchard.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Today, the Obama administration will announce a federal loan guarantee to build the first nuclear power plant in the United States in nearly three decades. The plan is part of an effort to curb greenhouse gas emissions and reduce dependence on foreign oil, also a major concession to Republicans concerned over cap-and-trade legislation and a lack of nuclear investment in those bills. The federal loan guarantee will help pay for construction and operation of two new nuclear reactors in Burke, Georgia. Aaron Gould Shinen is staff writer with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Aaron, good morning.
Good morning.
So what do you know about the plans for a new nuclear reactor in Burke, Georgia? Over $8 billion we're talking about, is that right?
I think actually about it, and it's done. They're estimating $14
billion
for the two different, there's two reactors that will be built there. They're well on their way. They hope to have a construction permit by next year. They've gotten some preliminary permits already from the NRC and from the state regulatory agency, and I think they're real excited about what the president's supposed to say today. They think it'll really help guarantee that the thing gets done.
And how many, over 3,000 jobs, do I have it right, that are expected in the area?
3,000 construction jobs, and they're estimating that when the plants are finished that they'll have 800 permanent jobs on site.
Is there an appreciation locally for the national significance of this? As we said, it's been 30 years since anyone's built a nuclear plant in this country.
Oh yeah, no question. The existing plant there, Plant Vogtle, already has two nuclear reactors, so they're used to this process. And they're used to having a nuclear plant in their communities and providing those kinds of jobs. But they are really excited about the possible expansion, the doubling the tax investment, the jobs, and the what they say will be possibly cheaper energy. But yeah, there's definitely a sense that this is something special going on in their area.
Okay, there are plenty of concerns about nuclear power out
there,
of course. What are you hearing in the community from people who might be opposed to this?
Well, they're sort of focusing on two different areas. One is the cost, because a lot of the cost is being passed on to Georgia Power's existing consumers. When the first two reactors were built at Plant Vogtle, the original estimate was for about $2 billion. Ultimately, it cost more like $8 billion. So
now we're up to 14 on this loan guarantee.
Just on the front end, right?
Right.
They're saying $14 billion, so they're worried about who's going to pay for that if there's cost overruns. And then the other real concern about nuclear power anywhere is not so much anymore about safety of the plant, although that's an issue, but it's about how you store the nuclear waste that's created from spent rods and spent uranium.
And what have they said about where the waste will go?
For the moment, they're saying that they're going to build storage containers and things on site at Plant Vogtle. But as you can imagine, that's really not a real long-term solution for stuff that could be around for a million years.
Right. Some people have wanted to put this stuff inside a mountain in Nevada. There's one particular majority leader in the Senate who has said that will never happen. I don't know if nuclear waste from Georgia will ever go to a mountain in Nevada. But, Aaron, I was a kid who grew up in the shadow of Three Mile Island. I'm from central Pennsylvania, and you could see TMI from the top of a mountain near my house. The safety concerns, there must be memories of nuclear accidents, even though it was all the way back in 79.
Oh, absolutely. And the China syndrome and all that. But, and especially after 2011, it's become a fear of terrorist strike, too. But mm-hmm. Georgia Power and the Southern Company are doing what they can to try and temper those concerns. But the NRC has already come back with some concerns over the original design, mostly, to make it safer to prevent terrorist attacks or to make it safe during serious weather events. So there's still a lot of questions to be laid out, but they're making progress.
All right. The loaning process is underway. The construction process soon to be underway. And certainly the PR process is underway for building of two new nuclear reactors in Burke, Georgia. Aaron Gould Shinen, reporter for the Atlantic Journal-Constitution. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley, and I'm here this morning with Todd Zwillick. Coming up,
call, stand up and get your call.
We're remixing Mardi Gras on Fat Tuesday. We're going to take you on a tour through the classics and some newer songs like that one in just a few moments. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. We're learning more about New Jersey Senator Lautenberg's condition. This morning, doctors diagnosed the 86-year-old Democrat with a bleeding ulcer. He underwent a successful procedure to treat it and is expected to make a full recovery. Staying with Congress, a day after he announced he won't run again, Democratic Senator Evan Bice tells CBS News he's not trying to hurt his party.
I am highly confident that we will have a candidate for the United States Senate who will be very competitive and have an excellent chance of winning this seat in November.
Bai also says he's committed to helping President Obama with his agenda for the next 11 months.
Today, President Obama is expected to announce an $8.3 billion loan guarantee to build two nuclear plants in Georgia. White House Energy Czar Carol Browner says the announcement signals a new American commitment to nuclear power.
We haven't built a nuclear plant in this country in almost three decades. What we're doing is jumpstarting that industry. Not only do we want to build these plants, but we want to be able to compete in the global demand for nuclear technology.
Building those plants is a major concession to some Republicans and moderate Democrats. And finally this morning, the U.S., Russia, and France say Iran's project to further enrich uranium is raising fresh concerns about the country's nuclear intentions. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Carnival time, at least for a little while longer. It is Fat Tuesday today, and this year Mardi Gras parades are going to celebrate the continued resurrection of New Orleans and the victory of the Saints in the Super Bowl, but try to imagine all that going on without music going on behind it. Grammy Award-winning jazz artist Terrence Blanchard and Nick Spitzer join us now. Nick Spitzer is host of the New Orleans-based public radio show American Roots. They're going to remix Mardi Gras for us. Terrence, let's start with you. You're from New Orleans. Your name is synonymous with the city that you come from in some ways. We just heard Carnival Time by Al Johnson. One of the things that that many people often say about New Orleans is you can kind of tell what the date is by what music is being played because it's so associated with the times of year.
Oh, it is. It is. I mean, that's one of the things that's interesting about some of the stuff that you're going to play. I mean, when you listen to Al Johnson, that kind of set his classic, well, it's Carnival Time, sets the tone for me and sets the period from where it was created. But the interesting thing about Mardi Gras music to me is that when you look at all of these different generations of artists who have created their own versions of this celebration, it is a chronicling of the development of music and the Mardi Gras celebration itself.
Oh, that's interesting. We asked you to pick out a song that kind of showed the different influences in this genre of Mardi Gras music. This one is actually about an Indian chief. It's mostly instrumental. It's called Big Chief by Professor Longhair. Why did you pick this song as a big influence on Mardi Gras music?
Well, this is a classic. I mean, you know, this is one of those tunes in New Orleans, man. I don't think you can grow up in New Orleans without ever hearing this thing. You would have to. I think most people around New Orleans will know the song without knowing the name. It's that familiar. When I was a kid, we always wanted to be able to whistle like whistle like Professor Longhair.
I wanted to be able to whistle Sweet Georgia Brown, like the Harlem Globetrotters song. Nick Spitzer, your host of American Roots. Can you tell us kind of what are the characteristics of music that's associated with Mardi Gras? How do we know if a song is a Mardi Gras tune?
Well, they often have march beats going with parades and second lines and that sort of thing. And then some of them are little narratives of what the life is like at Mardi Gras, like Carnival Time, or you hear the Dixie Cups doing Ico, Ico, also out of the Mardi Gras Indians tradition. I think it's interesting that both Terrence and I focus on Mardi Gras Indians, that is the African-American, Afro-Creole marching groups, men dressed in these sort of expansive Great Basin West costumes. And so you hear about the Big Chief, and they're singing about, you know, this is the day to be big, to be the big man, and there's wrecks and the fancy parades uptown, but to be the big chief in the neighborhood is to say, I'm important too.
Well, the lyrics
are important.
You picked, as you said, another one in talking about Indians. This is My Indian Red, your pick, recorded in the 1940s by Daniel Barker and Baby Dodd's Band.
The flag, boy, but watch that crazy wild man. The wildest in the lowlands, and you love our queen. Queen of New Orleans.
Nick Spitzer, is the era of the big bands in the 1940s, is that considered the golden era of Mardi Gras music?
No, I think a golden era of Mardi Gras music is whenever you're at Mardi Gras in any time or place. I mean, right now we've got all kinds of great mixes of Mardi Gras music happening and new versions, as Terrence is saying. And I just happen to love Danny Barker, and that's a little band that he put together actually in the late 40s. And it runs down all the characters, the queen, the spy boy, the big chief, the wild man. And it gives a kind of an upbeat New Orleans traditional jazz version of it. But you can hear, you know, hip-hop and bounce versions of the songs about the Indians and contemporary brass bands. And so the Indians go on and are a big part of Mardi Gras from the streets out.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Cajun music, because you certainly can't talk about New Orleans music without touching on the Cajuns. This is the Balfa Brothers. This is Danse de Mardi Gras. Terrence, one of the things that's great about New Orleans music is that the city itself is so diverse, and the musicians, I guess you could politely say borrow, but they steal all these influences from every kind of music that they're hearing.
Well, that's the part of the culture here. When you talk about gumbo, that's exactly what gumbo is. You know, gumbo is, you know, bringing together whatever you have to make something that's very tasty and delightful for everybody to share. When you started talking about, you know, the Cajuns, the first thing that came to my mind was that all of this music, the thing that it has in common is the celebration, you know, the coming together of all different types of cultures to celebrate this moment right before we have to give everything up.
That's right, sugar
days.
And everything else. Nick Spitzer, I want to play for you one of Terrence's songs. This is actually off his recent album, and the song is called New World. Nick, is this Mardi Gras music?
It can be if it's played around Mardi Gras. And also, you know, Terrence is very evocative about things. The new world and the way Mardi Gras happens here, it reflects the Mediterranean, the Atlantic, the French, the Spanish, and, of course, West Africa, mingling in the Caribbean and South America, whether it's Rio, Bahia, or back up here in New Orleans. And so when Terrence does it, he does it with authority from New Orleans. And when he makes that music, he's stating New World and Mardi Gras celebration. Whether you hear the old carnival melody or not, it's really how people use the music and celebrate with it.
Well, Terrence, New Orleans music is, and Mardi Gras music is certainly not set in stone. This is a genre that's constantly changing, and we kind of heard that with the Yin Yang Twins Stand Up and Crunk, that it's so associated with the victory of the Saints, and because right. It came at carnival time is maybe also right. Associated with Mardi Gras now. Is that that kind of sound that's gonna last?
Well, it's very interesting, like, you know, Nick was just talking about the whole thing about the transformation of the celebration itself is kind of represented by this particular song, because it was first of all associated with the Saints. They were playing it at the games every Sunday, and then when we started Mardi Gras this season with the Saints Parade, we heard this song just about on every float that passed by. You know, so now you start to hear the song on all of these other parades, and it starts to become like a Mardi Gras favorite.
Well, I will see.
And you got to know, the Saints all paraded last night at Orpheus. We're all on one float. Reggie Bush are all signing caps. I mean, the Super Bowl victory became carnival. I mean, carnivals yes. Every year. You know, but we haven't had a Super Bowl or any big victory in 42 years. So we don't know when that'll come back. So that's almost like been put as icing on top of the carnival cake this year. It's all been enfolded together. And that's a black-white team run beautifully, plays beautifully, and everyone feels carnival happy about it.
Nick Spitzer, host of American Roots, a weekly public radio program about American music. It's produced out of New Orleans. And Terrence Blanchard, Grammy award-winning jazz musician, also out of New Orleans. Thanks so much to you.
Crunk. Later this week, as we do every Friday, we look at this week's winners and losers in the news with our friends from The Week magazine. Tell us, who do you think's been having a good week and, of course, a bad week? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to the site, thetakeaway.org. And while New York hosts the Westminster Dog Show, we are hosting our own doggy competition. Our listeners have submitted over 100 photos of their dogs, and now it's up to you to vote. Celeste's Beagle is on there, up for best in show, but I maintain that Celeste
Beagle probably would win most spoiled.
She's not eligible. She would win Most Spoiled. Yeah. She's not eligible for Best in Show, unfortunately, but your doggy is. You have until noon Eastern today to vote, and we'll announce the winner tomorrow. And as we follow the Winter Olympics tomorrow, we welcome designer and Project Runway contestant Nick Vireos to talk about controversial ice skating outfits and what makes a figure skater fabulous. Nick is fabulous. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry all week.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway. Happy Fat Tuesday.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.